My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. In this episode, we speak with a former Royal Marine about conflict and healing. We talk about his time in Afghanistan, accepting his childhood, and the trip down the Amazon River that brought him peace. From Helmand Province to his book, The Psychedelic Marine, episode 44, Alex Seymour. This is Declassified.
I was brought up in a variety of places. I was born in West London, a place called Ruislip, and then we moved to Reading. But I consider my childhood to be pretty much the best part of it was in Bristol. So we lived in a village just outside Bristol, a place called Whitchurch, and there was a big, huge hill there. It was about 1,000 foot high, and we used to go to the top of that hill, and you could just see about 15-20 miles in every direction. It was stunning. It's really beautiful. Mm. I loved it.
Why was you moving about?
Well, I was on to my second father by then. My mother eventually married three times, four times if you count the last guy. She divorced him and then remarried him. So it's quite a checkered marriage history. But my real dad left when I was about two, and then she remarried and had two brothers. So there was three boys and him, and he had a job in insurance, and it just took him from A to B. So we travelled from London to Reading and then Bristol and then back to London. So after we left Bristol, which I thought was just wonderful and really brilliant in terms of the countryside and that kind of thing, he moved us back to London, and I just thought it was a bad decision because it was West London and it wasn't London's glitzy West End. It was a suburban area, and it was just a sprawl of semi-detached houses, and there was just no countryside, no greenery. And I just thought, he's really fucked up here. What? Why would you do this? Obviously, I didn't comprehend it was about money or that kind of thing.
How old were you?
I was about 12, 13 at the time. And so I spent from then until the end of school in that environment. And I just, by the time I was about 15, 16, I thought, shit, I've got to get out of here. I'm dying here. I'm really, not literally, obviously, but I was just, felt suffocated. I just wanted to get out. I just had a mad need for some kind of sense of adventure.
Was you still in contact with your biological dad?
Yes, I am now. But then I was not. No.
And then your stepdad, was he a father to you? Or
my stepdad, the next one. He was pretty violent. I look at it now with mixed emotions. Everything outside the house was good. It's a wonderful environment in terms of, my childhood in Bristol. But inside the house, it could get pretty bad. And there was a lot of beatings to either me or my brothers. And so when my mum left him when I was about 13 and moved on to the third father, I was secretly relieved, to tell you the truth. Mm. Yeah, but also, he... For good or for bad, he gave me a sense of, or instilled in me a sense of aggression. And I think that that aggression and the lack of encouragement that he gave me as a youth, when you kind of need some kind of strong, good father figure, it was just missing from my life. And so there was an embedded, instilled kind of thing to prove myself. Do you know what I mean? And I think that's what led me to a career in the military.
There's a difference between controlled aggression that spills over into violence, especially when violence is aimed at, non-violent people. The violence as a child, was it also towards your mother as well?
Yes, it was, yeah.
Was you witnessing it?
No, I wasn't aware of it until the end and she left him. And I think that was the tipping point. She'd had enough. And then afterwards, I found out that she'd gone to hospital, and it's as a consequence of him. And I just thought, this guy is best out of our lives. So that's why when we moved in with my third father, even though, you know, he wasn't the ideal man, it was better than, you know, where we'd come from. So I was secretly relieved.
Were you violent as a child away from the family?
There were a few incidents, yeah. Yeah, no one's ever asked me that before. But in all honesty, you know, I got into quite a few fights. And, you know, I'm not proud to admit that, you know, I instigated a couple of altercations, put it that way. So, yeah, I think I'm a firm believer that violence breeds violence. You know, his father, you know, looking at him in a kind of dispassionate way, his father served in the Second World War. He'd been blown up in the Navy, experienced a lot of trauma. And I just think there's this intergenerational cycle. Mm. You know, he'd experienced a hard upbringing himself, and he was just passing his frustrations on to me. So, you know,
it takes a certain kind of vulnerability to stop that cycle, I believe. What was your relationship with your mum like?
It was very good. Yeah, she was very loving. At the time, she was my rock, and it's always been really, really healthy.
Mm. And affection, love.
Yes.
Cuddles,
yeah.
And...
Yeah, yeah, totally healthy, absolutely, you know, full of love and warmth.
Did she encourage you as a child to kind of express the aggression in a positive way?
No, I think, I mean, through confrontations I've had with her, even in recent years, you know, basic conversations like, you know, why were you allowing this to happen? She claims to not have known. So she didn't know about, you know, the violence that was being bestowed upon me and my brothers.
And not to dwell on this too much, but how, because I can't work that out, how would it be hid? How could it be removed from her sight or her knowing?
Yeah,
did he manipulate? Was there a manipulation going on?
Well, no, I mean, he rarely hit me in front of her, and it was usually, you know, sharp, hard cuffs to the head, which really, really fucking hurt. Mm. And so I'd cry, but I'd cry quickly and you know, get over it. And so I don't think she witnessed that much. She might have witnessed it a few times, you know, ordinary smacking, that kind of thing, or ordinary as in back then in the 70s. But yeah, so I don't think she witnessed a lot.
Did you live in fear? Was there a need to please him?
Yes. Yeah, there's a definite sense of fear living with him. Yeah, yeah. And he was strict in the house as well. So it's chores all day long. You know, you had to do the washing up, the wiping up. You know, it was in bed by 6 o'clock every night when he came home on the nose. So, you know, it was a strict authoritarian kind of regime in that house at that time.
So 13 to 16, was this the next chap in your
yes.
life? Was he
yeah.
a better role model or was he different? What, how was that?
Yeah, he was much, much better because he only once did he ever lay a hand on me, you know, and that was just a misunderstanding. So, the just violence stopped as soon as we moved in with him and it was just a big relief. Mm. He was a lot more supportive. I mean, he was strange in his own ways. I don't know how my mum found these men because, you know, he had a strange rule where there was no TV allowed in the house. So I seem to be the only bloke at school that, you know, didn't have a TV in the front room. And he was always annoyed that I'd be raiding the fridge and eat too much food, as you do as a hungry teenager. So he'd have a cabinet and he'd lock a load of the food in a locked cabinet so I couldn't get to it. But other than that, those strange kind of idiosyncrasies that he has, he was actually, you know, a fundamentally sound, good bloke.
What did he do?
He had his own business cutting glass. So he was a glass cutter. So he made quite artful cut glass crystal decanters, tumblers, all of that kind of thing. He had a workshop in the back garden.
Daft question, did you have your own bedroom or did you share with your brothers?
Yeah, I did have my own bedroom, yeah.
And your two brothers, did they share?
Yeah, they did, yeah.
Did you all have a good relationship with each other?
Yeah, we did. I mean, there was a 4-year gap between each of us. And, you know, I was pretty tough on my younger brothers in terms of teasing. But, you know, I'd like to think they fared well. And we've got a great relationship now. So we all got in well. We met each other last year. Yeah, no complaints.
Do you ever protect them? Either in or out the house?
Yeah, only once, in as much as I found a kid wearing my younger brother's jacket in the playground once and pinged it straight away. I was like, hang on a second, that's my brother's jacket. And this kid said, no, it's not. And I just slapped him right across the face. And of course, I was straight in front of the headmaster. You know, you can't do that. That's not allowed. But I was saying, that's a thief. It's out of order. Anyway, so that's the only time I remember actually protecting him.
Sorry, go on.
But not, but in front of my middle father, no, I was too young to stand up to him at that time. I was just a very small child.
Mm. And academically at school, what was going on?
In terms of actual results? All right, yeah. I mean, on reflection, the school was, it was at the lower end of, you know, academic potential in terms of its results and performance. I mean, it could no way be called a Ofsted outstanding kind of school. And the fact that they bulldozed it down after I left, you know, is tantamount to the fact that, you know, the quality of its education could have been a bit better. But yeah, I left with a decent set of GCSEs and, or O-levels as they were back then. So yeah, left with about eight. And then I was going to do my A-levels and then ended up joining the Royal Marines instead. And so I finished off my A-levels in the Marines.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
During that period, the kind of the middle part of your teens, was alcohol, drugs, was there anything like that that had crept in? Was there a culture within where you lived externally?
Nothing out of the ordinary. I mean, we were getting pissed at the weekends, age 15, 16, you know, buying cases of beer and necking bottles of wine, that kind of thing, but nothing out of the ordinary. Just, it was just booze and fags.
Mm. When did you rock up to the careers office?
Age 16.
Go on.
So, yeah, I mean, I suppose, how did I stumble into, you know, having the Royal Marines as a career? I think the thing that kicked it off was they came into our borough, into the, what they called the county fair, and they did an unarmed combat display. They came down a fast rope from choppers and then just elegantly kicked the shit out of each other. And I just thought, fucking hell, wow, I want to be part of that. Give me some of that. They seemed like the, you know, the crash between good and evil. You know, they, you know, it wasn't that long after the Falklands War. And so I knew who the Royal Marines were. And I just thought, yeah, I want to be like them. And then I found a crumpled old leaflet in the career development room at school, and it just said Royal Marine Commandos on it. And I just thought, that's me all over. So I ended up in the careers office and, yeah, flew through the tests, did my three-day assessment, and then started training when I was 17 in the Commando Training Centre.
Mm, do you enjoy that?
No, it was horrendous. Looking back on it, I definitely wasn't a man. I was still a boy, but then I joined with 52 other blokes and they were all the same age. So we were all just turned 17. I can't believe they let blokes in at that age. You know, so, you know, I think even then, back then in the mid 80s, they gave us milk, you know, like the bottles of milk we have at school. Yeah. So, you know, you find general purpose machine guns, you know, part of the day and the other part of the day you're necking little bottles of milk. It's just weird. But yeah, it was really, really hard. Really, I mean, people know the school, you know, it can be brutal at times. But I did pretty well. I got promoted to section commander, and then they've got this this training rank called a diamond. So that's supposedly for blokes that reach a standard of excellence in training. So I got one of those with another guy. And then, finished training and then went to 4-2 commando. And so, yeah, felt pretty omnipotent then. You know, you feel like a titan because you're 17 years old in a unit full of 700 blokes and you've got, you know, flashes on your shoulders saying Royal Marine Commando, you're wearing a green beret and you think, yeah, made it.
Mm. And was it everything you thought it was going to be?
That first stint in the Marines. Yeah. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, absolutely. It was, you know, with bells on, it was fantastic. It was an amazing experience. We did, two tours of duty in, one in, Northern Ireland in 87, on active service, and another one in the Gulf. I was actually, after Northern Ireland, I got attached to a naval ship, HMS Brazen, which is a 22 frigate. And with my best mate from training, who's still one of my best mates now, Stu MacArthur, and we got posted straight from training to 4-2 commando to Northern Ireland to the same ship. And he ended up being in the bunk above me for the next 6 months. And then, yeah, we did about 25 countries on active service in the Gulf during the Iran-Iraq war. And then came back and ended up doing about another 18 months, year, something like that. And I was out after 5 years.
Why is that? Why did you leave after five?
It was a combination of things. One, I thought the promotion route within the Marines at the time was so slow. You know, it would take you about 12 years to get to sergeant. I'm not sure whether it's the same now, but, you know, and having grown up in Northwest London, and knowing the prices of property and how much it costs to have a family, that kind of thing, I thought, you know, even on a senior NCO's wage or a young officer's salary, you're going to struggle to buy a property, to have a family. And ultimately, you know, I wanted in my own home, I wanted a family. And I kind of miss London as well. You know, there's, it's a great clubbing scene that kicked off there. I was, you know, having as much fun as you possibly can when you're about 22 years old. Still friends with old school friends that I'm friendly with now. I was out with one last night. And that kind of lured me back. So I just thought, combined with the lack of control you have in the military, because, you know, as you know, they own you. They say go, you have to go. So after, you know, Northern Ireland, the Gulf, a couple of tours of the Arctic, doing Arctic warfare training, I just thought, well, I've got to get some kind of autonomy back in my life, and just thought, okay, done five, nearly 6 years, it's time to move on to something else.
What year was that?
That was about 91, I believe.
And then was the grass greener? Was you enjoying it when you got out?
I did kind of flit around kind of aimlessly for a couple of years. But then I did find my feet working for Diageo. So they're the people that make, they're a booze company that makes Smirnoff, Bell's, Gordon's, Pimm's, Johnny Walker, all that. So I worked for them for about 4 years, and that was good. But then what I'd consider kind of my salvation professionally was they invented the internet. And so it was just mushrooming then, you know, it's just really it kind of exploding in terms of the late 90s. And I just thought, I want to be part of this. This is going to change the world. This internet's going to be really, really powerful. So, yeah, I got into the internet business just haven't looked back really. After that sabbatical that I had, where I took a year off to go back to the Marines, which is what the book's about, I went back to the same career in cloud technology, in the internet.
We'll get to that in a bit. I mentioned kind of alcohol and stuff a second ago. After the Marines, did you then, was it just still just alcohol? I know you don't have an alcohol problem, but I'm just saying, as in a stimulant kind of form, did you experience, in brackets, drugs at this point?
In my early 20s, after I'd left the Marines.
Yeah, pretty much any time after that.
Yes,
really.
I did, yeah. So, like a lot of people, I monkeyed around with various psychedelics, a bit of MDMA, and booze. But I wasn't, a complete virgin to it by the time I got to the Amazon.
But would you combine that recreationally? Was you going out, because you said about the clubbing scene, so would you go out clubbing using this to kind of elevate your mood?
Yes. Yeah, I would say that. To have fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when you say psychedelics, what do you mean?
So when I say psychedelics, I'm talking about the classic well-known ones. So psilocybin, which is magic mushrooms. I wouldn't necessarily class MDMA, ecstasy, as a classic psychedelic, although it's associated in that kind of family, because obviously it's being increasingly used for therapeutic use these days. Ayahuasca is another one. Mm. And the more potent form of ayahuasca, the distilled form, DMT. Mm. So there's that. And then there's LSD as well.
Mm. And then, so what was the difference? So if I was thinking psychedelics, what's the difference between that and heroin and cocaine and things like that?
Yeah, there's a simple answer to that. I would say that psychedelics, in my experience, are open your consciousness. Yeah. So they can make you feel more connected, open, empathetic. Whereas, hard drugs like cocaine and heroin, the classically bad class A's, they're consciousness constricting. They make you more selfish, less connected, and destroy your health.
Mm. And where would alcohol sit in there then? Just in your opinion, I know it's a bit of a weird question to ask, but if you're mixing alcohol with a psychedelic as a 20-odd-year-old to enhance your mood and to enhance the experience, would alcohol counter that, or would alcohol enable that to happen?
I haven't got a strong feeling about alcohol, mixing them at that time. I think they kind of went hand in hand, but... if you're going to have a genuinely authentic psychedelic experience, obviously my recommendation is to avoid alcohol and just stay, on that one psychedelic for the experience and the duration that it lasts. But back then, I was happily mixing the two, but I wouldn't say I was an excessive drinker. I wasn't drinking any more than a normal 22-year-old guy at the time.
Yeah, recreationally. Yeah. I was... binge drinking left, right and centre and all the rest of it.
I wasn't even doing that. It was just, really? Weekends, Friday, Saturday.
Oh, yeah, me too. Yeah, that's what I mean. Weekends, Friday, Saturday, right. I was out, So, I get recreational. I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. I'm trying to kind of set the scene with that. When was your first child born?
1999, my daughter.
And... have you got a son as well?
Yeah, I have a son. Yeah. He was born a couple of years later.
And then let's fast forward, and you're married.
Yeah, been married for 22 years now.
Let's fast forward to 2008, 2009, when we're really seeing a lot of Afghan on the news. You're seeing a lot of Royal Marines on the news. Did you feel any kind of connection to that theatre of war, really? Did you feel any connection to...
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I mean, in some parts, I was watching it with a bit of envy. I felt there was a bit of unfinished business because I'd never actually personally experienced war firsthand. So, I was fascinated to watch the events unfold there. And I thought, they were doing a good job in terrible circumstances against a legitimate enemy. That Islamic fundamentalism, I just thought was... something that is bad, really, really bad, for lots of reasons that we already know.
But how old would you be at that point then?
I was late 30s, early 40s.
I've read your book, and you're the only person I've read the book before interviewing, and it is a remarkable book. But I was very much sympathetic, not even empathetic, towards your wife. What was the conversation initially then when you said you wanted to rejoin?
It wasn't easy.
Yeah.
But I just felt this lure. Just being around Royal Marines, there's always... I've always felt an excitement being around them. There's just something about being around those blokes that I just didn't get in civilian life. And... so I missed it, and I was getting more and more nostalgic for it. And so when the opportunity arose, and I just thought, well, there's an opportunity for me to take a sabbatical here in my work. I can take a year off. So I looked at joining the reserves, and then I mentioned it to my wife. I said, there's obviously a strong likelihood I could get called up for Afghanistan. And she was like, no way. No, just completely out of the question. You're nuts. I'm not having it. You're not going. Mm. And so obviously it took, you know, a while of some fairly ardent, you know, persuasive conversations on my part before she actually came round and said, okay, all right, fair enough, you've got my blessing.
And I'm always open when, you know, my response, I felt, and even when you're speaking, I feel like it was, and again, it's only because I've read the book and I'm kind of emotionally attached to the book as well, it was a real, it could be perceived as being reckless and very selfish of you to do that, especially with the children being the age they were. Did you feel responsibility to be a dad? Take that as you want and ask the question, but also to look after yourself as an individual. Does that?
It does. I mean, obviously there's a high risk involved, but I thought it was a risk worth taking. And, you know, I had a mindset at the time that was, some people could perceive it now as kind of fairly cold, but I just thought, well, I've got insurance up to my eyeballs. So if anything does happen to me, then, you know, the kids' educations will be taken care of, the house will be taken care of. And I kind of stripped my ego out of the equation. And if I boiled it right down, I had confidence in my wife, Julia, that she'd actually find another man if I died. And, you know, I like to think she's a good judge of character. So, you know, taking my ego out of the equation, she'd probably find another bloke that was a good man if she wanted to. And, it's only now, with hindsight over 10 years later, that sounds quite strange, but that's what I was going through at the time. And the upside of me experiencing what I'd always want to experience in terms of being fully tested in a combat environment, serving with the Royal Marines, it outbalanced the need to stay at home.
I can get it with a 19-year-old or 24-year-old. I really struggled understanding it as a 40-year-old with children. Why was it so important for you to kind of prove that, to experience that? That's probably a better way of putting it.
Well, there was another element as well. I mean, I'd been working in a high-pressure environment for, at least 15 years. And I had the opportunity, I mean, to have this, to take this time off. And I wanted a break. And I thought, okay, well, if I'm going to take a break, let's do something really purposeful, really worthwhile. And so that was part of it. But fundamentally, I think, in terms of my own character, I just thought, well, I just want to experience what it's like, you know, serving in a war in the British forces. And it was a test that I'd imposed on myself. But I think that was probably, you know, an old echo and a legacy going way back to my fathers that I had, particularly the middle one.
You know, in regards to what?
Just saying, you know, no encouragement, general abuse physically, verbally, that kind of thing. I just wanted to prove that I actually was, I had value.
Mm. Did you, what was your relationship with aggression at that point? Did you have an aggressive outlook during that period of time, in mid-30s to late 30s? And what was your relationship with it, aggression, and that link with being a man?
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously, if you've got those aggressive tendencies, you have to pair them right back and, you know, moderate your behaviour and just civilise yourself if you want to get on, you know, in a business environment successfully. So, and I was able to, you know, let off steam, obviously, from going to the gym. So I kept myself fit and all of that kind of thing. So it wasn't a problem. And, I even put up a punch bag in my garage. So there's only a couple of times I can remember where I had to come home from work and kick fuck out that the punch bag.
Yeah. But the relationship with it. So what I'm getting at is because you're so unique in the fact of your age and your family dynamic to go knowingly, because we have rolling news at this point, the internet was and everyone around you was well versed in what was going on. There was flights going back from Royal Wilson Wootton Bassett regularly. What I'm kind of alluding to is, did you feel like you had to prove it?
I did, but it was a mixture of three things. You know, I felt I needed to prove it. I wanted the sense of adventure. I wanted to experience that excitement that I'd had and lost. I wanted to regain that, even if it was temporarily for a year or so. But also, I'd had an experience a few years before I rejoined up with DMT, and it's a powder that you smoke. It's a very, very powerful hallucinogenic. Only lasts for about 10 minutes. But during that experience, I mean, I was in the right place, the right time, with the right people, with the right dose, with the right mindset. So all the ingredients were right. But, you know, you take three puffs of this hallucinogenic and you hold it into your lungs, and it has an ego dissolution properties. And it's so powerful, it literally gave me a fairly short-term out-of-body experience. So at the time, I got the sensation that my soul was leaving my body, and I was shot like a million miles an hour into, you know, what seemed like evolving newborn galaxies and solar systems. And it was this kaleidoscope of just wonder and psychedelia whizzing by with this intricate geometry, which just blew my mind. But that only lasted for the first couple of minutes. And then after that, there was this sense of, there was a presence, like a sentience, like the best way to describe it, I think it was like a God-type consciousness. It wasn't me, it was something else. And having that sensation and then slowly, slowly coming back and feeling an overwhelming sense of love and connectedness and relief, quite frankly, to come back into my physical body, back into the physical realm, the 3D space again. I got a sense that, you know, there is life after death. We are not necessarily just, what our meat bodies are as we, you know, go about our daily business. There is an alternative state of consciousness, and we may live after our bodies actually physically die. And of course, having removed that fear of death, you know, that was a pivotal moment in my life. Having removed that, it made me a lot less anxious and worried about going to war and dying. You know, it massively diminishes your stress if you've experienced something like that before you go to war, because you think it's all going to be fine.
And because you just said it, the insurance, the financial part of things was covered. And then you had this realization that there was another state of consciousness with the DMT experience. But what about the responsibility with regards, and again, I'm dwelling a bit on death here, because is that the ultimate? And I have a fear with young children of not being there for them. Was there any of that?
Essentially, I was confident I'd come back.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
I thought there was no point worrying about it. I was confident that I'd survive it and get through it. I wasn't sure whether I'd come back with all my limbs. I thought there was a, you know, fairly high degree of possibility that I might lose one of those. But, you know, people live with that and they adapt. And there's a lot of science to prove that, you know, people that lose their limbs get back to their original psychological set point of satisfaction or happiness or whatever, their original mind state, you know, a year after they've lost a limb. So,
or even greater.
Or even greater, yeah. So, yeah, that didn't worry me.
And so what was the process then? So joining back up for a year?
Yeah.
In that year, did you know you was going to Afghanistan?
Not in the first 6 months, no. So I was a year in the reserves. And then we were approached by Sergeant Major of Zulu Company in 4-5 Commando. And he said, look, you know, we really need, we're, the, basically what the Marines were saying, we're desperate for blokes. Those of you that are interested, you can apply. And he formally announced it in front of the troop of reservists at the time. And half of the troop were ex-regulars like me. And he asked, who wants to volunteer right then? And I just immediately stuck my hand up. Immediately, there's just no doubt, because obviously I thought about it. I knew it's a possibility. You know that, you know, as a serviceman, you're going to get called up as a high degree of likelihood. So I was, after a year, I was posted back down to my original unit, 4-2 Commando, for a year with them, six months of which was back in Afghanistan.
Was this the other six months before? So did you do like a build-up then of 6 months,
yeah,
and then do 6 months in Afghan?
Yeah, you do 6 months of pre-deployment training, which is pretty full-on. And it was strange for me because I'd had a 20-year gap. So...
Fucking, it is bonkers.
Yeah.
Forget about DMT. That is bonkers.
Yeah. Excuse me. So, yeah, so I was viewed as a bit of a curiosity, an oddity by the other young blokes. But, you know, I slotted back in and there was no dramas. And, it, you know, the physical-wise, physical training-wise, I'd managed to just about keep up with the young lads. You know, the average age of them was about 21, 22, something like that. And they were good blokes, you know. And I had the foundation there, the 5 years that I'd spent 20 years earlier, that was still there. Even the weapon systems were still the same. You know, SA-80 still there, GPMG still there, bayonets still there. You know, I think only the things that changed significantly was pistols. You know, they'd swapped to Browning for Glocks and SIGs, that kind of thing. So, yeah, the tactics of a Grav, a gravel belly Marine, hadn't really changed that much, so it was just picking up those old skills.
The mentality changed, the culture changed.
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think it's changed for the better. I think that the young Marines in this new generation were a lot more sensitive and had a lot more emotional intelligence. Well, not a lot more, but they were. Whereas back in the old days, when I say the old days, back in the 80s, early 90s, there was a very, you know, a lot more of a hard man sensibility. You know, they were a lot gruffer, harsher, piss taking is a bit more merciless. You know, they wouldn't suffer falls, you know, gladly or lightly. And a lot of them had just come back from the Falklands War, and you know, they were quite tough on people and didn't tolerate fuck-ups.
Mm. And then, so what would the difference be between someone fucking up then in 2010?
Yeah, well, guys would still get ironed out.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think, I think the standards haven't changed.
Yeah, no, standards hadn't changed at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the Marines, the standards hadn't changed at all, not one bit. As they haven't really since the Second World War. You know, the commander test is still the commander test. So, but, you know, back in the 80s, it was a little bit more violent, so they were a little less tolerant. So if, you know, young guys, you know, were gobbing off and, you know, weren't as respectful as they could have been or a bit too mouthy, they'd get filled in at night. I don't know if you know that expression, but that's a Marine expression for, you know, beaten up.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And they'd be, you know, the occasional what we call midnight shake. So guys would just come into the rooms and just, you know, fill in a young bloke. I didn't see any of that happening second time around or even hear about that, you know, and it's good, you know, because you don't want to work in an environment like that. Because, of course, you know, in that environment, the people that you're working with, you're socializing with, you know, and you're living with. So
also in an environment of fear, what does that, doesn't breed any form of positivity, growth, development.
Correct.
Beyond, you know, you mentioned it as a child, it's almost stifled you.
Yeah.
And then, when you look at, you can mess up, not twice, but you can mess up, learn from it, and then develop. It's a significantly more positive environment, especially if you're going into places where high risk and everyone has to be watching after everyone else. what was the, when you left, did you fly from Bryce?
Yeah, so we did the normal thing. We flew from Bryce Norton in, I think it's in Oxfordshire, RAF base to...
Yeah, what was the goodbye like with children and...
It was pretty emotional. It's pretty emotional. I just, it was the same as goodbye as when I had R&R halfway through the tour. You know, you say goodbye, walk up the drive, don't look back, tears in your eyes. It's hard, you know. I didn't want to look back at them. I knew my daughter was crying. And, yeah, cracked on.
I often found, I did it, but not to the extent because I didn't have what you had at home, but I would very much switch off and kind of start even before I was going anywhere. And to an extent, even now, I would kind of start switching off from people and start focusing. Was there any of that? Was there any behaviour change before you left? Of either what you're aware or that people around you told you?
Not knowingly, no. I was able to kind of keep it discreet and compartmentalise it. And yeah, I think I held it together in an okay way where there weren't any dramas.
Mm. And I'm not calling you a nice way. I'm not calling you a wimp. But I'm just... You are going away for a long period of time with not, you know, you haven't got the same access to conversations and all this kind of stuff. So I wasn't implying that. I was more implying the length of time and the fact that you're going from one thing and then you have to acclimatise to a completely new thing. How was that? How did you find that? How was that when you got there? How was that acclimatisation? Not just to the temperature, because that's one set of acclimatisation. There's also another, which is all about, you know, what's normal in West London is not normal.
Yeah, it was pretty instant. I do remember there were a few incidents. We flew to Camp Bastion, which, as you know, is like a military city in the middle of the desert. Just this awesome construction, you know, with state-of-the-art hospitals, you know, runways, God knows how many other ISAF allied forces in the same training environment. But as soon as we got there, I just sensed guys were getting more, not irritable, less patient with each other. So they tolerate mistakes a lot. They were a lot less tolerant of mistakes. You know, there was a brittleness to it. There were a lot more, I would say, a lot less patient and a lot harsher with each other. Initially, you know, there was a lot less joking, you know, people weren't being frivolous anymore. They, you know.
The switch had
They been, switched on, yeah. They had the game on.
Mm. And what was your role within this? Was you standing back from it? Did you feel like you were part of it as a reservist, although you had spent, you know, nearly 6 years in before? Did you feel you were there as a contributor?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you do have moments where you detach yourself and take a step back. But, you know, I threw myself into it 100%. So, you know, I wanted to be completely involved. I didn't want to be detached in any way. But there were a couple of moments where I remember this one moment where we were in this tent and there were 80 bootnecks in there. And it was, you know, we'd spent a whole day on the ranges, zeroing weapons, you know, we came in hot, sweaty, dusty, and I just remember looking around that tent and there were 80 Marine commandos in there, and it was really, really, the light was really dim and everybody stripped down to their waist and half the blokes were just covered in tats. It was just hot and dusty and wet. Everybody was, you know, using bunks, and I just remember looking around just seeing kit everywhere, just strewn, all the imaginable kit that you take out, you know, when you're on ops out in the field properly, you know, things like your medical kits, just a jumble of weapons, really, really sophisticated sniper weapons, just countless different types of knives, Leathermans, K-bars, commando daggers, all that kind of thing. And they were, you know, either cleaning their kit, cleaning their weapons, starting to get their heads down. I just remember thinking, Jesus Christ, you know, I would not want to be on the wrong end of this bunch of blokes because, you know, get ready. You know, these guys have got, you know, they're not going to be taking any fucking prisoners.
Mm.
And I just remembered feeling quite humbled then, looking at, thinking, you know, really, really proud, thinking this is the cream of British youth here, you know, and they're ready, fighting fit, literally, to go and attack the enemy and fight and win.
What was the role?
I was in a multiple, so it was a group of 16 guys, and we were in a fort on the front line in Nadi Ali, which is a hairy place. And so I was... 2010,
What month was this?
This must have been May. Yeah, we got
2010,
out in,
okay.
Yeah, in May. So, you know, I was a grunt marine, frontline combat marine.
Hmm. But what, sorry, beg your pardon, so that, and what would that entail? So you're in a fort. What would the day-to-day be like? What was the kind of mission of you guys?
It was pretty full on in terms of the workload. So, you know, I won't labour the point because most people, you know, are aware of what conditions are like out there, but the temperature is a killer. It's red hot. So it's like 120 degrees every day, every fucking day, you know. Centigrade wise, you know, you're looking at minimum 40 degrees centigrade. Sometimes it would get up to 50 degrees. Mm. And so we'd be out patrolling every day and every night with no days off. And as you know, if you're out there in a forward position, supporting other units, just hunting Taliban every day, you hardly get any sleep. So you come in from patrol. Patrol could last 4 hours. It could last 8 hours. It could last 10 hours. You come in from that and you'd have to deal with, you know, whatever you encountered on that patrol. And then you get shit together, do your admin. And then you'd also have to do guard duty on the Sangers and the two Sangar outposts obviously afforded protection.
So the perimeter of where you were staying, there's always someone there watching, is there?
Yeah. So we had to divvy that up. There were 16 blokes and we had to divvy that up between the 16 of us in those two Sangars. So what that means is in terms of sleep, you never, ever, ever seem to get more than 4 hours sleep, 5 hours sleep if you're lucky. And there's no routine to that sleep at all. So, you know, it could be from 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. one night. It could be from 10 a.m. to, you know, 2, 3 p.m. In the afternoon. There was just no rhythm. So your whole body clock's completely fucked. So the combination of that, you know, you're patrolling with 120 pounds worth of kit and weapons, 120 degrees worth of heat, 100 patrols, hardly getting any sleep. There's no days off as well. So they all blur into, you know, one seamless, you know, there's no Saturdays or Sundays. So you lose a lot of weight. I lost, you know, a lot of weight.
Let me get on to weight in a second. Just to kind of get it into everyone's or my mind, when you say you're in a fort or a compound, is that brick? Is that mud? Is that HESCO? What's the perimeter wall like?
Yeah, so it's made of HESCO, which is basically these wire frames filled with gravel and concrete and that kind of thing, and it's built into a very rough square shape. It's as simple as that. And then on the two opposite ends, there's a taller tower, the two Sangars. So that would have some stairs up to it, and that would give you and afford you, you know, ability to look out over the surrounding landscape, so you could spot threats coming in.
Could you climb over it?
There was barbed wire around the outside. So it would be difficult to climb over.
And what to get in and out? Is it one way in, one way out?
Yeah, there was one way in, one way out. And the gate was pretty shit, to tell you the truth. I mean, we must have gone 3 months. It was a wooden gate, and you literally you lifted it. You know, we had there was a guy called that was on duty all the time called a gate bitch, basically.
It's imaginative.
And so whoever's job it was that day to get the gate would, you know, the gate bitch would open up the gate and, you know, the patrol, let the patrols in and out at any time, day or night. But it was literally, you'd physically grab hold of this wooden gate, which is about 10 feet high. So you couldn't see through it, but it was pretty flimsy. And there was no lock on it. There was no lock, so anybody could have crept up from the neighbouring village or any insurgent or anybody wanted to do us harm and just literally opened it. It's only about halfway through and managed to secure it.
When you talked about sleeping and living accommodation, air conditioning tents?
That's what really pissed me off. It was tragic finding out that, you've got this bunk, not a bunk, you've got, you know, a camp bed and a sleeping bag, and you're in this tent and you can't go in it during the day because it's so blisteringly hot. It's an instant sweat box. So if it's 40 degrees outside, it's easily 50 degrees inside the tent. So we could never really go or live in the tent in daylight hours, you know. So as soon as the sun came up to when the sun went down, so we would just basically live in the shade.
And I'll move on in a second, mate. how big was it around? So how long was the walls on either side?
I'd say probably about 30 meters.
Okay, so not massive.
No, it's just enough for 16 Marines to operate and patrol and sleep and eat in.
And then where would be the nearest kind of allied forces from you?
About 3/4 of a mile.
Okay, so again, you're not together, clumped together. It's a big thing. And then this constant, I'll say rhythm, but this constant kind of battle rhythm of out patrolling, back in. Was it high risk? Was you in a state of fight a lot? Was you relaxing? Could you chill out and just forget about everything? What was your nervous system kind of doing it during this point?
I mean, obviously, when you're out on patrol, you know, weapons are fully loaded, you know, you've got a roundup spout and you're on super, super high alert. And I suppose that was one of the things I wanted to diminish when I got out. And one of the reasons why I went to the Amazon, but we'll probably come on to that. But yeah, so you're out on patrol and you're literally watching every single step that you make with laser vision, because the IEDs out there, the bombs that the Taliban would lay, there were multiple different types. Some were pressure plates, some were vehicle borne, some were suicide vests. And so, you know, obviously you get the education and the training out there of all of these different types of threats, sniper fire, suicide bombers, everything. So you're on super high alert. So personally, and I think I can speak for the rest of the other guys, just being aware of their mental states, once we got back in, and we weren't on Sangha duties, we did switch off. You know, you had to. You just couldn't. You'd mentally degenerate if you were under such high stress constantly. So, yeah, we were able to chill out and relax when we got back to the fort.
And was you thinking, was you dwelling on things, you know, paperwork you hadn't sorted out back home? Was you thinking about the children, their day-to-day? Was you thinking about the life? Was you allowing your mind to wander?
Yeah, you do have moments. I mean, obviously, you know, you have moments of self-reflection, but you know, it started off, I mean, there was no messing about. I mean, it kicked off pretty quickly. You know, guys were going down, there were casualties. 4-2 commando, my unit, ended up having 7 blokes killed and many, many casualties over that 6 months. So in terms of thinking about my family, I kind of mentally cut myself off then, because we had these satellite phones and I did use them when I first got there. And, you know, it's literally a hi, darling, how are you? How's the kids? The typical thing when you're having those conversations. But after a while, I just sacked it off. I just thought, you know, what am I going to tell them? You know, life sucks here. You know, I've got no control over our lives. Military's got us by the balls. People are getting blown up. It's the usual war story, right? There was no happy, upbeat, lively tale to tell. So I just pared back the contact and I ended up writing letters instead. And I found the expression of writing a letter on those little blueies that the MOD provide was good, and it was enough. And, you know, I could write those to my family, and we still got them.
Mm. Yeah, it's a real historical piece as such. And just to give, you know, if you haven't listened to J.J. Chalmers' episode, you know, probably 2 years ago now, that was all part of that same tour, you great mates with JJ, and that's how me and you are sat here now. That's through Mr. Chalmers.
Yeah.
Fast forward, you go on R&R, you come back, you're straight back into it again, finishing the tour and coming home. Look, yeah, I can imagine homecoming being amazing. Did you feel different? Did you feel better? Did you feel like you fulfilled what you wanted to fulfill?
In part, but I thought there was another step to take. And because, you know, you just mentioned JJ there. I mean, that was an emotional point for me. JJ was, you know, my best mate in the Marines. And, you know, we got posted from the reserves together. He lived in Scotland, and instead of being posted to 4-5 Commando up in Scotland, he ended up being posted to 4-2 Commando down in Plymouth. Typical bootneck, you know,
logisticness.
Yeah, logistics. Just anyway, he sucked up and he stayed in London. So every weekend I'd drive him to London and back. So we got to know each other really, really well. And he was, you know, you know what it's like. He's got a seriously upbeat personality. He's you know, great, great bloke. So, you know, there was a day when I just heard this massive explosion, an idea gone off, and I just thought, fuck me, that sounds really, really properly nasty. And so we mobilised to get out the fort, quick reaction force, and then news soon came in that JJ had been blown up. They were searching a Taliban commander's bomb-making factory, as we'd done multiple times ourselves, you know. It's just, I remember rooting around one myself and going down on one knee to speak to Yoda, our sergeant, and nearly kneeling on a hypodermic syringe and thinking, fucking hell, you know, this is 500 yards from our fort. And knowing that there's a kind of nest of Islamic fundamentalists smacked out on their heads on heroin, just literally down the road with the intent purpose of trying to kill us.
Mm.
And it's really sobering. So JJ's catastrophic IED encounter, I believe it injured him terribly, but it killed three blokes immediately. One of whom was Sam Alexander, who's the best mate of one of my other best mates, my multiple, Jono. And yeah, we all took it really hard, especially Jono. And he was only allowed half an hour to grieve, you know, by our troop sergeant before he had to, you know. I mean, it just sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? You know, best mate killed. All right, take half an hour off, get your head together, get back in the game.
Mm.
And he did, you know, to the power of Jono. He's a fantastic human being. Anyway, so to your point, was I different when I got back? Yeah, there was all kinds of stressful encounters out there. And, you know, a lot of them have just outlined in the book. But I just thought, I'm going to need to wind down. I need to properly have some downtime here. Not just, you know, I'm not talking lying on a beach and getting a deeper tan. I'd had, you know, 20 of those holidays. I wanted something more significant and a proper opportunity to just literally calm the fuck down, because all your senses when you leave, I mean, personally, you're on high alert for 6 months, pretty much. And so I just thought, you know, I need to take some serious time out here and regroup and come down to a level where I wasn't on such high alert and I could assimilate back into civilian life sensibly, calmly, without any dramas.
Mm. That the incident you just referring to with JJ, we've also recorded with Cassidy Little as well.
That's right, yeah.
And then those two, they speak at different angles, but it was a real defining moment for a lot of people, and a lot of respect was given around that. Both of those conversations around that, and you know, go if you're listening. I don't really speak to the listener, but if you are listening, those two are certainly worth. You'll know exactly what Alex means. So why? So you come back 6 months away, then you reconnect with the family. You then say to your wife, right, I need to pop off again, and not just down the road. I need to go to the Amazon.
Yeah. I mean, there were a couple of choices. It all stems back to my first encounter with the DMT. It was almost like a spiritual awakening, because I'd gone from, you know, being completely non-religious, atheist, to awakening something then. And I knew if I went to the Himalayas and you know, communed with a guru, you know, in the Northeast, that was a bit like a 20th century kind of cliche. So I didn't want to do that. What I was unequivocal about and absolutely had my heart set on was going in the opposite direction, down to South America, to explore ayahuasca, which is the plant brew medicine that's been used by the indigenous tribes there for millennia for its healing properties. And it's a couple of plants mixed together to make this kind of a tea potion. Tastes disgusting. And that, so the indigenous tribes have been consuming this in a kind of shamanic healing ceremonial setting for forever, seemingly. And I had another former Marine to blame for that. That was the BBC presenter Bruce Parry.
I've just wrote his name down. I was just going to question, because that was the first time I saw it do it on that tribe.
Yeah.
So sorry, go on.
So I'm laying the blame fairly squarely at Bruce's door here. So I've met Bruce as well. You know, another inspiring human being. He's got a TV series on now on BBC, as you may have noticed. He'd done the ayahuasca ceremonies in the Amazon jungle, lived through it, and because of the element of DMT that was in the ayahuasca brew, it just lured me, you know, like a moth to a flame. I was like, okay, I need some of that. I knew it had the ability potentially to make me unwind from the Helmand Taliban Afghan experience and help me assimilate back into modern life again.
Heal.
Yeah. I mean, when I say heal, I mean, I was pretty lucky. I don't think I had any classic symptoms of PTSD, but I certainly, you know, my head needed sorting out, as does anybody's when they're in that environment, you know, because the military, they lay on your official, you know, force fun. I think you have 48 hours when you get back of compressed R&R in Cyprus, don't you? You know, and so you had that, but it's just not enough. But luckily, you know, they give you a couple of months of time off afterwards. And so, yeah, I was able to, you know, take that time and go down to the Amazon.
But was that a maturity in that decision? It sounds like it.
Yeah, like I say, I didn't want to lie on a beach. I know what that experience is like, and it's fantastic. Everybody loves a beach holiday. I wanted something much more intoxicating, real, and a new experience, and something that wasn't just physical. That was
therapy as well. Therapy gets a bad rep, I think, because I might have said it on here before, if a marathon runner gets physiotherapy, no one thinks anything of it, whereas a Royal Marine in Helmand in 2010, you know, you're going to go through a lot of psychological, because your nervous system's firing and you are in a high risk for a prolonged period of time in intense conditions, carrying intense weight, people around you getting blown up. You're absolutely in your right. And like, that's why I said it's a mature thing to say, to go and seek some form of therapy. And that comes in different guises. And please carry on.
Sorry. Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, it was, I suppose, it sounds like a blunt word, but it's growth. You know, I wanted some kind of growth and enlightenment. And I'd had some kind of awakening, my first experience with DMT, and that was immeasurably unforgettable. And I knew my life would never be the same. So, you know, that's why I just thought, well, I can continue this, but I continue it in a safe setting, in an exploratory way, in a natural environment where there is no war. There's just total peace in the jungle. So, it's completely transformational.
I don't want to go into every single stage of the Amazon, because the book, I read it recently, and it was really, it teed things up for me. I'm speaking from a personal point of view, because I think our child is quite similar. Reasons for joining are quite similar. And it really framed things for me, the book. So I would really recommend, you know, going in and getting The Psychedelic Marine. But just to broad brushstroke it, what does the ceremony consist of, and why? What? How long was you there? Did you do it once? Did you do it 5 times? What was the process of that trip in the Amazon?
Yeah, so it's about, there was about 15 ceremonies, something like that. I mean, traditionally, I use that in the kind of loosest sense of the word, but traditionally in a tribal setting in the Amazon, a ayahuasca ceremony is led by a shaman, and it's in a hut called a maloka, which is a circular hut, maybe 20 meters wide, and people drink a teacup or a small glass full of the ayahuasca brew, and then lay down on a mattress. And in nearly all circumstances, there's a shaman leading the ceremony, and he and maybe one or two others would sing these songs called Icaros, and they're traditional tribal songs, and they're really amazingly powerful. These guys can belt out tunes, but they're in a completely incomprehensible language, in ways that are nothing like our own conception of music. So it was very strange, very weird, but you'd feel under the sense of ayahuasca that you could feel the music of these Icaros just reverberating through you. So, sometimes they would, sing really, really close to you, within like 2 feet. And so you can imagine getting serenaded by, Pavarotti or an opera singer. You take that and times it by 10, it just goes straight through you. There's this wall of sound. And if you combine that with the intense feelings of psychedelia and, the visionary aspect, which is really, really otherworldly, and you're in a jungle and you can just hear, the chirps and rasps and, a million different insects, all the natural jungle wildlife outside of the Maloka. It's overwhelming. It's literally overwhelming. It's so overwhelming that a part and a known and completely wholly acknowledged part of the ayahuasca ceremony is to purge, also to puke. So, you drink it after 30 minutes, it would settle in your stomach. The visions would come on really, really strong. You get a sense inevitably of, oh my God, what have I done now? Am I coming back? That usual, fear. And then most people, I'd say kind of 9 out of 10, me included, you'd have a bucket there and then you puke into the bucket. And then after that, then after the waves of nausea would go away, then you'd settle back into it, and it'd be a lot more comforting, and the visions would calm down, and it would be a lot less hectic. So that's typically what an ayahuasca ceremony is, and they last for about 4 or 5 hours. And then it just gradually winds off towards the end, and then you just naturally fall asleep, and you wake up in the morning, feel completely refreshed and, with no hangover.
During the ceremony, those 4 or 5 hours, are you like during the hacienda, or are you laid down? What hour are people walking around? Are you with it? Do you understand?
The club in
I did understand. I did mean the club in Manchester. Are you like gangster tripping, or are you in a state where you can relax? It's serene? What's the...
It's both. Yeah, it's both. So when it comes on for the first hour, it's full on balls to the wall, you know, massive hallucinations. So, you know, reptilian figures, you know, ancient kind of archetypes in terms of, you know, lizards, dragons, all kinds of fauna interwoven with these massively intricate geometric swirling shapes and all kinds of colors. And a lot of it at times I felt was kind of polished as well. You know, you'd look at the scales of some kind of imaginary reptile that was appearing, you know, let's call it, I don't know, something like a snake, or, you know, a crocodile or an alligator, you know, an ancient, because these visions, they're animals coming from the jungle into your consciousness, whether you like it or not. So it's utterly fantastic. But they'd appear, you know, you'd look at their eyes or their scales, and they had the kind of high definition kind of translucence. It was literally that clear, like you're actually seeing them as clear as you and I are sitting apart from each other now. Is it amazing what...
Oh, so they are there, they're not... They're there.
They're in your mind.
Oh, you've got your eyes closed?
You've got your eyes closed, yeah.
Oh,
but also,
man,
when you open your eyes, they're still there. Like, so, yeah, whether you like it or not, you know, you could have a really macho approach to taking this, going, oh, you know, I can, I'll take it, but, you know, I'm going to be determined not to feel it. You know, I can handle it. I won't feel it. Yeah, good luck. All right, it's going to get you whether you like it or not. You can't deny it. And so, yeah. So I would take turns of having bouts of the experience with my eyes closed, and experience the ceremony with my eyes closed, but also with my eyes open. And so you'd be looking up at the roof of the Maloka, and you could just see all again, massive. Just beautiful geometry and all kinds of strange and delightful sights.
If you look at things like the ancient Greeks, the Romans, the Native Americans, or they all have this similar process of healing or ceremony, and it really is upheld as this higher kind of thing, really. I don't know how to explain that. Yet we demonize it so much in the Western world, and we demonize this, and we seem to... We're so much more conservative. Who was out there seeking this? Was it just you and a tribesman, or was there other people going out there seeking something else? Was you finding common ground with Westerners? Or...
Yeah, there was the Western seekers, the Western travelers. But also there was a growing community of veterans as well. So, before I went out there, I became friendly with an American Marine called Ryan LeCompte, and he'd set up a charity called, Veterans for Entheogenic Therapy, which again was, you know, plant-based medicines, ayahuasca therapy. And he'd made a CNN documentary. I'd seen that on YouTube, to get over his trauma that he'd experienced. As well as his friends. So there's a growing community of ex-service people and other people that experience trauma, you know, firemen, people on frontline services, that kind of thing. There's that. But I also want to circle back to that point you made of there seems to be this consistent experience across different cultures that have these experiences in their traditions. And I think you're absolutely right, there is, but they've been managed out of modern civilization. So a lot of ancient civilizations, some of which are, you know, still going now, obviously down in South America, and certainly in North America, a lot of the Indians, they have these peyote ceremonies, and they commune with these plant medicines, these that have got healing properties, these allies that they sometimes refer to. And there's a lot of people, and I'm one of them, that think that the fundamentals of, you know, the of religious thought were actually birthed out of these ancient experiences with these plant medicines, these mystical experiences that you attach you to some kind of sense of the other outside yourself and interconnectedness, there's something there, and it's undeniable. But what's happened in our civilization is that, you know, they've been managed out of society. You've got an intermediary now. The classic religions, you know, the Roman Catholic Church being a great example, you know, you have an intermediary there. You have a priest, and so he's then the gateway to get to, you know, the higher state of communion with, you know, God, for want of a better word. See, what psychedelics do, certainly in the ceremonial setting, is they completely remove that middleman. You know, so you have got direct experience with something that feels very, very sacred.
Mm. And this isn't, I know you mention religion, but like, and in the same breath you mentioned it had been managed out. And if you look at history, certain religions have managed these rituals out, yet it would maybe connect again, maybe it would connect them even greater. What is your relationship with religion?
So I would say, before I was an atheist, and I didn't have much time for the traditional, you know, religions. You know, I grew up in Church of England as a Protestant, but I view them now as more elements of, or institutions of control, to be able to kind of manipulate. Certainly, you know, in centuries gone by, I mean, obviously they're less powerful now, and for good reason, but they were able to manipulate people and coerce them a lot through, you know, fear-based manipulation, you know, through, you know, all-powerful God that, you know, and if you made them upset, you know, that their wrath would...
You'd burn.
Yeah, you'd burn. So, you know, as a modern person in the 21st century, I viewed that with a fair degree of... contempt, to tell you the truth. Yeah. I mean, obviously they have their place and they offer a lot of comfort to some people, and in the right, there's a lot of what they do is good. But if you want the direct, profound sense of felt experience, to some sense of, you know, an otherworldly connection to, I mean, my personal experience, it was a sense of, the only way I could describe it at the time was a sense of holiness. It really was. It was just, I'd never experienced anything like it. My hands came together in the ayahuasca ceremony every time, from the first one to the last one. They came together in a kind of a prayer-shaped formation.
Well, fingers together. Yeah, fingers together. And that is used in ancient yoga practice. It is a way of connecting, isn't it? Putting your fingers together to connect your body.
I couldn't stop it.
And it was coming together,
coming together, yeah. And I would keep them together for you know, hours at a time, you know, during the summer. Yeah. It was very odd. So, this sense of sacredness and holiness, I just thought, well, you know, this has just been these altered states of consciousness that are completely natural, given to us by plants, have just been completely taken away from us as a civilization.
Mm.
And to you know, an extent they have. If you think about, you know, Richard Nixon, the war on drugs, early 70s, you know, a lot of these classic psychedelics were just instantly made illegal and demonized, and they had so much therapeutic potential that they were taken out of society.
And they were being trialed. There was advances. Correct. Going through, you know, there's a video of, you know, Royal Marines getting...
Yeah.
Climbing trees, feeding birds on LSD.
Yeah.
And there were testing and trials, and then it all stopped. And we're 30 years, 40 years beyond now, and it's starting again. There is, you know, it is legitimate, you know, Imperial King's College in this country.
That's
they're
right.
At the forefront of psychedelic trials, whether that's MDMA or the active ingredient in magic mushroom. You know, there is this. Where would we be if that? Well, that's irrelevant now. I keep saying relationship because I think it's a very good way of putting it with you. What is your relationship with psychedelics, and I broad brushed that, now or in the last 10 years?
Well, since I got back, well, it's a love story, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've, you know, a profound respect for them. I think there's a real purpose for them in our society, and particularly for things like ayahuasca and psilocybin, so magic mushrooms. So there's a lot of excellent science and research that's going on now, you know, with impeccable academics like Dr. Professor Nutt.
Yep, from Imperial, yeah.
Imperial, yep. Yep. As well as Dr. Robert Carhart Harris. He's doing some fantastic research to help with people's anguish and problems through problems like depression, addiction, anxiety, you know, all kinds of things. So it, obviously it's not a panacea, but, you know, certainly for things like PTSD, you know, the Americans obviously a lot of the time are one step ahead of us and, you know, to their detriment sometimes. And they were, a lot of the guys coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan were, that had PTSD were being heavily prescribed antidepressants, SSRIs, which is just basically like a plaster.
What's SSRI? What is that? What does that mean again?
I think it stands for something serotonin reuptake.
Yeah, inhibitors. Okay, it's giving you more serotonin or balancing it. Is that right?
Like I say,
there is, you know, you mentioned two names there. Those two were on a BBC Two documentary, May 2021. It's called A Trial or something like that. And it was all about what you just said there. They'd put it in. It was really excellent. It was really excellent.
Yeah.
And they mentioned all this stuff in there.
It really works. So there's a lot of academic research now. And MDMA is also one of the extremely likely promising hopes to help with PTSD. So instead of, for example, you know, you come back, you're experiencing stress and you can't assimilate back into modern life, and you've got PTSD, it's been diagnosed, and then you get put on a course of antidepressants. Ultimately, the pharmaceutical company, they get rich by, you know, keeping you on those for life. Whereas there's a lot of evidence now with, you know, certain psychedelics, you know, and I'm including ibogaine in those as well, which is one that's come from Africa, which is really, really powerful for you know, treating addiction. But it was, for example, people would take MDMA or psilocybin, and just with, you know, there are reports of just a few doses, like one or two doses, and that was it. That was it. The symptoms of PTSD would just evaporate, or certainly be a lot more manageable. So all of this is now coming out of the woodwork, is becoming a lot more mainstream. There's a brilliant institution in America. I've met the guy that runs it. His name's Dr. Rick Doblin. It's called MAPS. I don't know if you listen to Joe Rogan at all, but
that is where I first heard about psychedelics properly, was that episode.
Okay. Well, he's just done another one last week.
Oh, really?
Okay. So Rick Doblin, he wrote a blurb from a book, God bless him, who said some nice things on the jacket cover. He's been running MAPS now for over 30 years, I believe, doing this kind of research to, you know, treat people with addiction and blights like PTSD a lot more compassionately with psychedelics. And so MAPS, it's an acronym. It means Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. It's quite a mouthful.
Yeah. Just for the record, that was take 8.
So Rick Doblin, you know, he's a top bloke, and, you know, long may he continue to do what he's doing. You know, they really are making some breakthrough research now with these medicines.
What is it done for you personally on kind of the bigger picture? How has it made you? Has it made you a better man? Has it made you a better human? Has it made you a better parent? What has it done for you?
Yeah, I believe it has. I mean, it's all part of life's rich tapestry, isn't it? Because, you know, after we'd left the first part of the traditional ceremonies, which is written about in the book, in a traditional ceremonial setting in Amoloka. I then went on to do something a lot more experimental and some would say wilder, going on this tour called the Mythic Voyage. So this was taking the ceremonies out of the tribal setting on a boat. And I mean, I could tell you about that in detail later on if you want, but basically it was such a magical, profound experience. It enabled me to come back a lot calmer. I think I'm more certainly, you know, dissipated aggressive tendencies that I've got, able to be much more empathetic and compassionate with my children, and you know, I wouldn't say evangelist, but a strong proponent for advocating these with other people that have suffered, and you know, I recommend it.
And childhood relationships with your mum, dad, what was their link with that? Did you come out, did you come off the back of,
yeah,
of the Amazon to, specifically with
yeah,
with
this? Yeah, so I was able in those ceremonies to kind of lay those ghosts to rest. And I just remember coming out of one ceremony, you know, reflecting on my relationship with my three fathers, thinking, Alex, you just got to let this shit go, you know, just put it behind you, don't dwell on it. There's zero value in taking any kind of bitterness forward and just leaving it there behind me. So yeah, I think it was really, really beneficial.
Mm. And in terms of kind of a way forward, I don't know the legalities around it, but would you take them again? Do you take them still? How do you?
Yeah, yeah. So since then, I've been back to the Amazon. There was a documentary that was being made for American veterans to go down. And I think the title of the documentary was called, it's like a play on Apocalypse Now. So they called it Ayahuasca Now.
Okay.
Yeah. So there was about seven American vets that had all experienced different degrees of trauma in different wars, one of them going all the way back to the Vietnam War. And because of the book, I was invited, so I was the only Brit along. And so I've been back to experience it. Then I've been back to the Amazon to go on another mythic voyage.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Because in the book, it's not a spoiler, I thought you'd really fucked up going on that about six pages in, and it wasn't until the end where you're like, no, it was...
Yeah, it wasn't legit. Without its dramas. And I thought I'd really fucked up at one stage as well. But no, it was just all, you know, completely, you know, imaginary fear.
Mm. So you went back for the second time as well and did it again?
Yeah, went back for a second time and a third time as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. So I've been over there at least, you know, three times.
Mm.
Plus I've had experiences in the UK as well with ayahuasca ceremony in the UK.
Mm. This is not an advocation for taking anything. You know, therapy has to be dealt with in a very sensitive and right way. This steps forward with trials and all the rest of it. And this is your experiences. We are not telling people to go, you know, pick up anything and just start doing it. You know, you did it in a very calculated way. I'd absolutely recommend the book. Is there anywhere else people can go to kind of look at this? Not just your experiences, but, you know, we've mentioned maps.
Yeah, so there's another charity set up by a great guy called Jesse Gould. It's called the Heroic Hearts Project. And it's for vets that have experienced troubling times, PTSD. There's a lot of American SF guys that have got a lot of value from it. And they've just opened up, I heard recently, they've opened up a UK branch. And I'm not connected to them in the UK, but Jesse, who started that charity, he's an American Ranger in the Ranger Regiment. It served in Afghanistan. He was with me during that documentary that we're making, mm-hmm. Ayahuasca Now. And so, Yeah, I support them, and I think they're a wonderful organisation, and yeah, all power to them.
Alex, thank you so much, and we will leave it there.